Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, February 28th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be gathering around the virtual water cooler and talking about what we've been up to. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Jacob, it's good to have you back on the podcast. What have you been doing recently?
Yeah, I want to talk briefly about a newly released movie box set, the Universal Monsters Limited Edition Collection. Full disclosure, I was sent a copy of this. I did not pay for it myself. So, you know, grain of salt with all that, but, you know, it's critical responsibility here, letting everybody know. This is the new oversized Blu-ray 4K release of 8 Universal classic monster movies. It's the 8 you'd expect. Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy, Creature from the Black Lagoon, The Wolfman, you know, it's the big ones, but not necessarily the many, many sequels. Like, you're not going to find, you know, The Creature Walks Among Us, or I guess the one sequel you get in the box is Bride of Frankenstein, but probably the most famous and best of the Universal sequels. Mm. And the reason I want to talk about this set is because I think some people are wondering if it's worth getting. And I just want to say that I think that Universal has generally treated its monster and horror legacy with a great deal of respect over the years. And this set continues that trend. The 4K transfers of these movies look and sound phenomenal. I mean, if you've ever seen, you know, 4K high def, you know, versions of anything shot in film, you know, before the 80s, it's like, holy crap, movies looked good. And even movies like these, which were, you know, little horror movies, sometimes made on budgets, you know, between the 30s and the 50s, they look incredible in 4K. It's kind of wild. So if you're a Universal Monsters fan who's just interested in having the best looking versions of these movies, of the like the 8 core, like undisputed classic films, this is such a must buy. I mean, it's the limited edition is a little pricey. The Amazon price looking at it right now is $130. So the question is 8 movies in 4K in this oversized, flashy, and I think really cool looking limited edition packaging worth the money? And that's, you know, where it comes down between you and your wallet, you and your responsibilities, what's important to you. As somebody who loves physical media and wants to display, you know, this oversized case in his media room, because it was not going to fit on any regular shelf, and also wants to have the best possible looking version of these movies, it is absolutely, you know, I would have bought this if I was not sent a copy. And I think that even though there are no new features, the commentaries and documentaries and trailers and everything assembled on all the discs is, you know, pretty comprehensive. Like all stuff you'd want for a release of Dracula's on the Dracula disc. Also, if you want a Frankenstein, it's on the Frankenstein disc. So if you're looking for new special features, it may not be what you're looking for, but you're paying for the 4K restoration. And I am kind of bowled over by how good these movies look. I will say that there, a couple years ago, Universal did release a Blu-ray box set of pretty much the complete Universal Monsters canon of 30-something movies across multiple discs. You know, it's regular Blu-ray, it's not 4K, and my guess is you can probably get that cheaper now, or at least cheapish compared to this new release. Mm-hmm. So my advice to people who are Universal Monster fans, who are trying to make a wise decision here, you know, do you want the undisputed masterpieces looking better than they ever have before? Or you want everything, including the weird, eccentric stuff that nobody really likes, but it's kind of there because you want to have the complete story on, you know, regular Blu-ray. So it's going to come down to, you know, your wallet and your needs. I have both. and if they release a box set that's the entire couple of years, it's like it's all the movies, you know, in 4K for an ungodly amount of money, I'll probably buy that. So yeah, I just want to shout this out. So the official name of the product is the Universal Monsters Limited Edition Collection. There is a 4K set of 4 movies. I think it's like Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy, and one other on 4K as well for much cheaper. But if you want the full 8 4K restorations, this is a set to get. And I know it's a limited edition, so I don't know how limited that means or how long it'll be around. But, you know, if you're a fan of, you know, oversized physical media sets, this is something that I would recommend that you at least take a look at.
So Jacob, I think you're the biggest Universal Monsters fan that I know, and I know that we've talked about your love for all of those movies before, but I have never asked you, do you have like a singular favorite among all of those, or even just the classics that you mentioned there?
Of the undisputed classics, the best one is Bride of Frankenstein. It is funny and low-key gay. It was made by largely gay filmmakers and who were winking a lot in the 30s. It's spooky and interesting, and it has my favorite Karloff performance, or at least my favorite Karloff as Frankenstein's monster performance. I mean, some of the classics are a little difficult. Like Dracula is based on the Dracula stage play rather than the Dracula novel. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of feel how stage bound it is. But some of the others, like I think that both Frankensteins are phenomenal movies. The Wolfman is so evocative and interesting. But if I had to pick one that's like that stands out above the rest, the classic amongst the classics, it'll be Bride of Frankenstein. However, okay. If you want my opinion on my personal favorite one that I think is the most interesting Universal Monster movie and it's not in the box set, it would be the one I mentioned earlier, The Creature Walks Among Us, the third in the Creature from the Black Lagoon series, which is the most depressing and bizarre and like ambitious swing for the B-movie fences I've ever seen from like the Universal Monsters canon. So in terms of like an actually great movie, Bride of Frankenstein, in terms of a movie I think is great, but it's definitely not, you know, regularly considered S tier, The Creature Walks Among Us.
Okay. Now, I've only ever seen the original Creature from the Black Lagoon. I've never, I guess, dipped my toe in any further to those waters. But do you think that it's worth me going through and watching all of those movies, like in order, I guess, to get to that one?
Yes. I'll give you the elevator pitch, Ben. Creature Black Lagoon, you've seen it. Classic.
Yep.
Go to the jungle. There's a creature in the Black Lagoon. Shenanigans happen. The sequel is pretty much, what if the creature was abducted and taken to SeaWorld? It's basically the and escapes and causes havoc, and it's revenge of the creature, and it's pretty good. It's okay. It's very much, it's lesser than the first film, but it has its charms, including the very first role ever for Clint Eastwood looking like a little baby in it. Kind of sneezing into the microphone, I apologize.
Okay.
But the Creature Walks Among Us, Ben, is about another expedition to the jungle to research the creature, leads to a fire which destroys the creature's gills. In order to keep the creature alive, scientists give him a lung transplant. So now he can no longer breathe underwater and now lives on land. And they try to put him in human clothes and teach him how to speak and essentially try to force this creature to live among humans and be like, we can prove this thing can be trained, that it can be, you know, tamed and made one of us. And the answer is that no, it's not that easy. But it's not just the creature kills people movie. It's the creature is desperately sad and wants to die because it no longer has its gills movie.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that does sound pretty depressing. Okay. So let's get into what we've been reading. I read the, what is the word for it? It's the stage play written by Agatha Christie called The Mousetrap. I'm not sure. Is there I guess it's the book. Is that the technical term, like the theatrical term for the?
The book is a term for a musical. Like it was a book by, lyrics by. I'm not too sure if a book would apply for a stage play, but I could be wrong.
I'm sure there's some term that I'm
telling us right now, Ben.
Yeah. anyway, yeah, she wrote this this stage play back in the early 1950s, and it I think is the longest running West End show, the longest running play in the world. Something like almost 30,000 performances or something. It's been going, it basically ran continuously from 1952 until the pandemic hit and that had to shut it down, but it's since resumed, I think, as of 2021. Anyway, if you're familiar with Agatha Christie's work and the sort of formula that comes into play with the Poirot stories and things like that, this is just a very, very condensed version of that. So I found it to be a pretty enjoyable little read. I mean, it literally took me like a few hours to read. It's like, I don't know, like very, very, very short. Jacob, I feel like you could read this thing in like 10 minutes with how fast you read. But yeah, it took me a little bit longer, but definitely like a day because it's only a few pages really. But yeah, it's just like a very enjoyable, very condensed one location, handful of characters, murder mystery type of story. And I very much enjoyed it. So I'm obviously not going to spoil anything that happens or whatever, but I would just recommend, like, if you are a fan of Agatha Christie's novels, and if you've been reading a bunch of those for a while and want to mix things up a little bit, just check out The Mousetrap, which is, I think, the only major play that she wrote, as far as I know. So
have you heard of Akaton, Ben?
No, I haven't. What is that?
Akaton, I know it's because I recently went on a binge where I started buying all the there was this series of Agatha Christie publications published in the 80s through the early 2000s, where these faux blue leather bound versions of all of her works. And I said, if I'm going to own these books, I should buy them all in this edition. And I started like scouring used bookstores and got all the ones that are super cheap and got all the ones that are a little more expensive. And I've gotten most of them now, except for the ones that are prohibitively expensive and, out, and like long, long gone. They look really, really neat on a shelf. I recommend them if you're a book collector. But one of the ones that I give you an idea of how comprehensive it is, while doing research for Death in the Nile, Agatha Christie compiled so many notes about ancient Egypt and Egypt in general that she wrote a play for fun called Akaton. It's not a mystery. It's a drama history play set in ancient Egypt. And it was never produced in her lifetime, but it was found after she died and is now published and has now been performed. So it's Agatha Christie's essentially historical ancient Egypt play. And I'll never get on the reading it, but it exists and it's out there.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, never heard of that. And now I'm looking this up and I realize I should have looked this up beforehand. She's written like 15 plays or something. So just the fact that I've heard of The Mousetrap and that is her most famous one. That's what I should have said. But yeah, she definitely had many, many other things that she wrote. And she actually has like a list of probably 10 or so unpublished, like one act or full length plays as well. So anyway, I would say The Mousetrap. If you're a Christie fan and haven't checked it out, check it out. What have you been reading recently, Jacob?
I recently finished Kubrick and Odyssey by Robert P. Kolker and Nathan Abrams. This is the new biography of filmmaker Stanley Kubrick. It's good. I have issues with this book, which I'm going to get out front of right now. I think that their authors are a little too protective of Kubrick at times. They're so desperate to remove some of the myths and lies about him that they sometimes go overboard. The book is pretty open about him being a very difficult collaborator, about him being somebody who would often seek credit that wasn't his or try to undermine people who worked hard. Basically, like early Kubrick tried to take credit for cinematography stuff that wasn't his. For his entire career, he would undermine writers and just treat writers like crap, actors too. But the book also tries to go over, talk about how much members of his crew really did respect him, and how for a guy who has a reputation for being cold and cruel, had like 17 cats and 6 dogs, and was like a really loving guy to his pets and to his family, and which is this very, very complicated portrait. Like Stanley Kubrick is not just some evil bastard who tormented his actors and made 2-month-long shoots stretch into 14 months, which is, you know, a very common conception of him. He was just a guy who was difficult, challenging, demanding, and sometimes a total asshole, but was not one thing. He was more complicated than that. But I do think there are points in the book where the writers will try to hand wave away some really crappy behavior by saying, but look at the results. Like, for example, the Shining chapter in particular, where it goes into great detail about the misery he put Shelley Duvall through for a year of filming, like really heinous stuff. But then like they come to the conclusion of, but her performance is so good. And I'm saying, yeah, it is a great performance, but I don't think that's a good excuse. I think you can kind of walk that line. My other issue with this book is that it's 600 pages long, and which is probably about right length of time you need for, you know, to cover Stanley Kubrick's career from beginning to end. And there are points where it just gets repetitive. Like they'll tell an anecdote at one point in one chapter, then a chapter later repeat it, and it's always in a different context. But it really feels like there was a lack of editing finesse at times. Like an editor should have caught that. Oh, this story's been told twice. We don't need to have people here. And it started happening enough times for me to sort of raise an eyebrow. So with that out of the way, I still found Kubrick and Odyssey to be illuminating, entertaining. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot about the making of all of his movies, about him as a person, about his many, many unmade movies. Like there's entire chapters dedicated to him developing the film that would become AI, that Spielberg would ultimately direct. And those chapters are a real trip because that's 30 plus years of a guy not knowing what he wants and burning out a dozen different writers along that path. I will say that if you're looking for like in-depth making of each of his movies, this may not be the place for it because, you know, you can only spend so much time on an individual movie before you have to move on. Like, for example, I was kind of surprised by how little time was spent on Clockwork Orange, but also I found the stuff about Full Metal Jacket utterly engrossing. If you want really in-depth material, there's a book called Space Odyssey that I discussed on this podcast a few years ago. That's one book about the making of 2001 Space Odyssey, and it is a genuinely incredible book and the best book I've ever read about Stanley Kubrick in any way, even though it's about the entire film and about everybody else who worked on it. But if you want just an overall career portrait, everything from his 1950s work, The Spartacus, 2001, all the way up to Eyes Wide Shut, as well as his unmade Holocaust film, The Aryan Papers, his version of AI that didn't get made, looks at what his Napoleon film would have looked like, just the many, many people who were his great friends and his worst enemies, Kubrick and Odyssey is worth reading. I just think you should approach it with your own, one, with the knowledge that I think it needed some editing, and two, I think the authors probably need somebody to tell them, hey, I know that you can get close to your subjects, but maybe getting a little too close here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, that's a great recommendation. Kubrick and Odyssey is the name of the book. Let's take a break and then we'll get back into what we've been watching. All right, Jacob, I rewatched Dune, Denis Villeneuve's 2021 movie, for the first time since it came out. And I watched it at home on HBO Max when it debuted in theaters and HBO Max simultaneously back then. And then I rewatched it. I guess technically I watched it on Netflix this time. Man, what a movie. I liked it more. I liked it a lot back then because I had read the book, you know, leading up to it. And I liked it even more this time. I just like am a big fan of what he's doing there. I know people have mixed feelings about that movie and his adaptation choices and whatever. But like, God, what a movie. It feels singular in a way that that you kind of have to have for a Dune story. Like, it's such a weird, weird story and a weird movie in many ways too. I'm so glad that I read the book before engaging with any filmed adaptations of it, just because I have to imagine that it's like, it can feel impenetrable to some people. But because I had that knowledge base of me reading the book ahead of time, it was much, much easier for me to clock the dynamics between characters and things like that, and like who's doing what and why and all of that stuff in the movie. And I think all of that was just like further clarified for me on a second viewing of the movie. And I just think it's a really, really, really like top tier blockbuster experience. So I don't know, you're about to talk about seeing Dune Part 2 in just a minute. But did you revisit the first one before you caught up with the sequel?
There are a handful of movies that my wife watches and rewatches and rewatches. Like, she'll just have it on while she's doing laundry or while she's knitting or while she's doing some busy work for at her job. And those are movies that I've now seen dozens of times because she'll have them on and I'll often be in the room. Like, I've seen David Fincher's Dragon Tattoo maybe 30 times now because that's one of her movies. And one of her movies has become Dune. Dune is always on in my house. Sometimes with subtitles, sometimes not, sometimes booming, sometimes like nearly muted. But it's always, always playing in my house. And it was funny because going into Dune, I was one who was really excited. I was one who was like, who'd read the book? And I was like, oh my God, this is going to be so exciting. This is totally up my alley. And my wife's like, oh, I like these actors. You know, maybe I'll like this too. And she's become the Dune head. So I didn't necessarily need to rewatch Dune specifically for Dune Part 2, Ben, because Dune is in my house about once a week.
Yeah.
I agree with what you say. I know that the David Lynch film has this people have sort of come up out of the shadows, be like, hey, it's actually good. It's actually a really good adaptation of Dune. And I fundamentally disagree. I think the David Lynch film was a disaster as an adaptation and as a movie. And I don't think it captures what I think is special, unique, and enthralling about Frank Herbert's novel. I think there's bizarre moments that are interesting, but it's not. I cannot get on board the train of people who are like, hey, this movie's actually good, because no, it's not, guys. Come on. I do think that Denis Villeneuve, he just lends a grandeur and a respect to Dune that I just feel like, in the same way that Peter Jackson, when he filmed the Lord of the Rings films, treated them like they were actual important events. Like, this isn't just a fantasy story. This is the fantasy story. And I think Dune is the sci-fi novel. And I there's no trace of camp in Denis Villeneuve's Dune. It's just like, you know, somebody who clearly sees that novel as genuine literature worthy of like utmost respect, and he shoots like it's Lawrence of Arabia, and he's not shooting it like it's, you know, a Marvel movie. As somebody who likes Marvel movies, it's shot like it's something like that, like demands your attention. I think it's a remarkable film, and we'll talk about Part 2 in a second.
Yeah, shout out to Greg Fraser, the cinematographer, who just like does absolutely incredible work in that first movie. I mean, I'm so excited. I have my tickets to see the second one this coming Thursday night, tomorrow night. So I can't wait to dive back into Arrakis. But yeah, I just wanted to give a shout out to that the 2021 movie, because it held up even more, and I liked it even more the second go around. So that's that. I think it's streaming on Netflix and HBO Max. Netflix, I believe it leaves at the end of this month, end of February. So like by Friday, it'll be gone off Netflix. So just a PSA for anybody who has Netflix and wants to catch up with that. Okay, I also watched Paprika for the first time. Have you ever seen this movie, the Satoshi Kon movie?
Well, Satoshi Kon is one of my big blind spots, and a former slash film editor turned inverse editor, Hoi Chan Bui, is screaming at me right now for not being up to date on this.
Well, she recommended one of his films called Millennium Actress to me a few years ago, and I watched that and really, really enjoyed it. And it's just taken me a few years to get around to checking out another one of his movies. I believe he only directed four films, but now I've seen two of them. And Paprika is came out in 2006, and it's pretty fantastic. I mean, speaking of weird movies, like it's almost tough to follow in certain parts, but in a great way, like kind of like I'm trying to think of another comparison that isn't Inception, because that's the big, there's like such a conversation has sprung up. Are you aware of this conversation, Jacob? Have you like read any articles comparing Inception and Paprika at all?
Yeah, it's the new Dark City versus the Matrix.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So this movie came out a few years before Inception, and Nolan's Inception has a lot of imagery that is basically like, it's not a beat for beat remake of the story or anything like that, but some images seem to be ripped directly out of this movie. And people, there's like a lot of articles out there that are like, oh, this movie influenced Inception, and like Nolan, you know, cites it as an influence and all that. And I was looking before we started recording today. I have never found a quote where Christopher Nolan has actually talked about this movie at all, or like admitted that this, you know, that he's even seen this movie, let alone that it like was he was doing any sort of homage, or that it got into his head subconsciously or otherwise or whatever. So I have no idea where these people, I feel like people are just making stuff up and being like, yeah, there are similarities, so it must have influenced that movie. You kind of have to have a quote from a filmmaker before you can like say that definitively. So anyway, just wanted to put that out there. But yeah, it's basically about a dream terrorist who steals this device that lets you go into people's dreams during like waking hours and everything. And it's really, really incredible imagery, and like some of the most like twisted kind of unbelievable stuff that really only works in animation. And it's a trippy little movie, and I would definitely recommend checking it out. I watched it on Tubi. It's streaming on there right now, like a couple ads throughout or whatever, but it was not like a disruptive experience for me, as somebody who never really watches anything with ads anymore. Yeah, I thought it was like very much worth watching, and like just a fascinating lens to view, or a fascinating like trip into somebody's head. And like, I think the big knock against Inception was, you know, it's kind of a cold and sterile movie. That's something people say about Nolan's movies all the time. And they say, you know, the detractors of that movie talk about how like the dream stuff didn't go far enough, and like the imagery in that movie is not wild enough or like unhinged enough. And if you're looking for that, you'll absolutely find it in Paprika. It feels more like an actual dream instead of, you know, the sort of like, dream gimmick, I guess, if you want to call it that appears in Inception. So the similarities are kind of hard to ignore at this point, because both movies seem like so so in conversation with each other. But I kind of want somebody to ask Nolan about this directly, because I would love to hear what he physically has to say about this instead of just people like reading into you know, the imagery that appears in Inception. So
I have a speed dial.
You have Christopher Nolan speed dial. Yeah, I guess, you know, in the lead up to what is probably going to be Oppenheimer's complete domination of the Oscars, I'm sure he's not busy at all or anything. So yeah, let's get him on the show right now.
Yeah, get him to take accepting an Oscar, saying, by the way, I've never seen Paprika, peace out.
That would be unbelievable. Okay, so yeah, we alluded to it. You saw Dune Part 2. How was it, Jacob? What did you think about it?
Dune Part 2 is phenomenal. If you liked Dune Part 1, this is just I feel like saying just more of that, it sounds like a negative thing, but it really, the film doubles down on what made the first movie work, and it does some really smart thematic choices. Without getting into spoilers, it brings some of the ideas and heft from the next book, Dune Messiah, I think, into the narrative here. I think it's possible to read Dune and think, man, Paul's an awesome dude, and his whole plan is awesome. Whereas Dune Messiah is a book where it kind of goes, well, maybe things weren't so good. Maybe you should think twice about all the things that you do as a character. I think that Dune Part 2 wisely leans into that, where it lets Timothée Chalamet, who's really, really phenomenal here. Like, he's good in Part 1, but I think he really shines here. Lets you really follow a guy who's desperately trying to avoid being the hero, but not like in a refusing the call way, but in a I want to save billions of lives way, which lends a thematic heft and like an emotional weight to this movie that I think really works. The idea of, you know, Paul Atreides being a corporate created messiah, so to speak, is I think tackled so interestingly here. But yeah, the movie is huge. Like, it never feels stage bound. It never feels like you're watching something that was cooked up in computers, even though, you know, lots of it was. I just watched it with like going, oh, this feels like a substantial piece of art. This is for the first time since, you know, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings, you know, a genre adaptation that feels as big and as important as this. I feel like we'll probably talk spoilers on Dune 2 in the future, so I don't want to go too long, but I had a phenomenal time here. It's surprisenly funny. I saw it Sunday night at the IMAX preview audience screenings, and jokes were landing more often than they did in Part 1. I think it's because the relationship between Paul and Shani, played by Zendaya, is very much a central focus here, and they have a really strong relationship and a really good dynamic that leads to some really fun and funny and romantic moments. But on top of that, it's just the weirdness is still present. Like, the film is just completely unapologetic in its this is a weird planet, and we're going to embrace that. Like, there's an extended sequence set on the Harkonnen home planet where we first meet the new villain played by Austin Butler, and it's full of the kind of visual swings that I don't think Villeneuve could have gotten away with on Part 1, but now in Part 2, he's like, I'm going to go for it. I mean, I don't have to explain the science of it, but the Harkonnen home planet has a black sun, which leads to all outdoor scenes in Harkonnen planet having this bleached black and white look. And it's like, it looks like H.R. Giger from the Alien films designed an entire planet. It's wild looking. And Austin Butler's voice... I guess this doesn't count as a spoiler, so I'm gonna go ahead and just, if you don't want to know anything about Austin Butler's Dune 2 voice, you know, click ahead 30 seconds. But Ben, Austin Butler's doing a Skarsgård voice.
Oh, okay, interesting. I thought that he was going to be doing his Elvis thing again.
No, he's doing the Stellan Skarsgård, Bill Skarsgård voice. He's bringing that raspy Swedish accent. So it's funny because Dave Bautista is supposed to be his sibling. Remember the same family, and he still uses the Batista voice, but the two scars. But you have Stellan Skarsgård, and then you have Austin Butler doing his straight up Skarsgård voice. I kept thinking this shouldn't work, but it's absolutely working. So yeah, I feel like I haven't even touched on why Dune 2 is great beyond much little details. But straight up, if Dune 2 impressed you, sorry, if Dune 1 impressed you at all, then Dune 2 will impress you as well. I cannot imagine Dune 2 not being something you enjoy if you remotely enjoyed Part 1.
Okay.
If you didn't like Part 1, if you weren't buying what that first film was selling, this one is not going to win you over. It really is doubling down on that tone, on those ideas, and on those visuals.
Okay, man, I'm very excited. Yeah, I think the plan is for us to watch, or is for us to do a full spoiler conversation on Friday. So maybe you'll have time to join us for that, or at least part of it or something, Jacob. So we'll have to see, fingers crossed on that. Tell me what you've been playing recently, the last segment that we have here.
Yeah, the game of the moment right now is Helldivers 2. And I'm going to be the hipster who says, well, I played lots of Helldivers 1. I knew it before it was popular. Because 100% that is true. But also, let me be that jerk for 10 seconds, then I'll stop. But Helldivers 2, the first game was an isometric top-down shooter where you led a squad of soldiers to very sci-fi planets fighting aliens. It was sort of a couch co-op game. Whereas this new one, it's a full-on third-person shooter, squad-based. You and other people play online, go on various missions to various different planets, shoot lots of aliens, get experience points, upgrade your equipment. But what made the first game so fun is present here, which is the fact that it's intended to be absolutely chaotic. I'll give you an example, Ben. You know how in video games, if you're playing a first-person shooter video game, if you fire five rounds out of your gun at an enemy, you can then hit the reload button, and it reloads your gun, and all your ammo is still there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Helldivers 2 says, well, if you fire five shots out of your magazine and hit reload, you just threw your magazine on the ground, so now you just wasted a bunch of ammo. Sorry. So that's like the kind of thing, like little things like that, or like friendly fire is 100% a thing. Like friendly fire is unforgiving. If you shoot your ally, you will kill them. And then stuff like, if you want to call in extra ammo, you have to literally get on your radio, hold down the L1 button on the PlayStation 5 controller, and input a series of commands to call down additional ammo, or call down a sniper rifle, call down a rocket launcher. And the idea is that it seems easy at first, but then like, my God, we're out of ammo, surrounded by enemies. Who can call down ammo? I'll call down ammo. Okay, cover me. Oh no, I'm being shot. I can't cover you anymore. So it leads to the idea that the game has all these tiny little hindrances. The idea being that you gotta watch how you reload. You gotta watch how you call down reinforcement. You gotta watch where you're shooting at all times. It's intended to be difficult. It's intended to be like, if you're not on your headset talking to your team at all times, you're gonna die. You're gonna die very, very badly. And it leads to, it's so funny though, because it will be like, we're surrounded by these giant alien bugs. I'm going to call in a turret. I'm going to call in this Gatling gun turret that will be airdropped down. So I'm going to throw it down. And then the giant pod containing it slams in the ground. But whoops, the pod has hit one of your allies and has killed him. And then the Gatling gun emerges from the ground. And it's aiming at an alien who is right across the map from where your other ally is, so the Gatling gun kills him while trying to kill the aliens. So suddenly you're trying to dodge your own Gatling gun while bringing back your revived allies to stay alive. And it's the kind of game, Ben, where at the end of each mission, you gotta call for evac. You gotta call for the giant jet to come pick you up. And the jet can and will land on you if you're not clearing the path. So it's really funny. So on top of being difficult and challenging and requiring constant communication, it is funny. Like when you die, you're like everybody's laughing. Like if you play with the right group, and I recommend playing with people, with friends, or finding people who have good senses of humor. It just becomes so incredibly funny. It's one of the funniest video games I've ever played for that reason. Because just the game wants you dead, and it has a billion different ways to kill you. And they're all funny. And this is on top of the other thing that I kind of want to lean on. This is a movie podcast. This is essentially Starship Troopers. The whole joke of the game is that you're hell divers. You're these futuristic sci-fi soldiers sent in the battle, and your characters are basically instructed that your job is to go teach all these different aliens about democracy by killing them. So Starship Troopers was deliberately like, we're fascists now. Helldivers has a sort of a hey, we're here to promote democracy, wink wink, we're actually fascists thing going on. And so the ongoing joke is that you'll be shooting giant alien bugs who do not speak English, and character will be shouting for democracy. Or like you'll be on your ship between missions upgrading stuff, and somebody on your ship will like have like incidental dialogue. My favorite one so far was somebody saying, the existence of high casualty missions implies the existence of low casualty missions, and that's a blessing, or something along those lines. So it's just really, really strong sense of humor. The satire is thick and juicy and extremely fun. And if you go on various fan forums or the subreddit for it to look for advice or look for tips, the community's really embraced it. So they'll be like, they'll be discussing like, the game's really popular, which means there have been some server issues. So people are discussing, I'm really trying to spread managed democracy out of the galaxy by keeping kicked off the server. Anybody have any advice? So so even though people are like, even when they're like complaining or looking for like tips or saying this mission keeps on killing me, they're often doing it in character. The game's universe is encouraging you to be like, man, I really want to go out on a mission to like spread democracy tonight. Anybody else want to come help me? So like, I'll literally text my friends and be like, hey, anyone want to go spread democracy tonight? And we'll jump on and we'll go kill bugs.
That's great.
It's gotten really, really funny. And I really, really appreciate that. There have been Starship Troopers games in the past, but none of them have really stood out and been very good. And Helldivers 2 captures that Paul Verhoeven sense of humor that I think is missing from those previous adaptations, at least the ones I touched. it's just a really fun game, Ben. And if you have a PlayStation 5 or a decent PC, it's also on Steam. It's great. You don't even need to be good at it. Like I said, half the fun is dying horribly and laughing. So that's Helldivers 2. I recommend it a lot.
Is it one of those games where you have to play online, or is there like a single player campaign?
You can play solo, but there is no campaign. The entire game's happening in real time. Like when you jump on into the game, there's a map of the galaxy where the various different fronts in the war are. Right now there's two different enemies to fight in two different wars, and there's room to add more. You can clearly see the space where they can add, you know, factions 3 and 4. And you essentially pick areas where the enemies are advancing or your troops are advancing, and you are essentially encouraged to fight in different fronts. And it's very much a community effort. Like it's like very much like going, like the game pretty much says you can go anywhere you want and fight any planet you want, but this area is where the robots are pushing back, or this area is where the bugs are reclaiming territory. So it's this constant ongoing push and pull with the community saying like, hey, try to keep the front, you know, where it needs to be. So you can play these solo, and I've done a little bit of solo play just to get some experience points and get some experience on the ground learning new weapons and stuff, but it's a game's very much built around multiplayer play, and you can play with randoms, and I've had some fun playing with random folks. The game's pretty good about letting you kick people who are gonna be jerks, or people who shows up and aren't being useful or are just being assholes. I just kick them immediately. I generally try to play with people I know, and I'm building up my my team right now. I have 4 or 5 people who I can rotate between, thankfully, to try to get full squads. But you can have fun with strangers. I've had plenty of fun with strangers, but if you have a dedicated team of people, you start learning the shorthand, you start like get running jokes going. Like one of my friends just keeps on killing me by accident. It's not his fault, but it's become like a running joke. Like, you know, like every time we land on a planet, I'm like, okay, make sure you don't kill me. So it's just really, really, it's a really great co-op game in that way, because it just creates memories and jokes immediately. But you can still have fun without that. But I do think the game is a 10 out of 10 experience when you play with friends.
All right, last question. When you die, presumably in a comical way, are you allowed to respawn, or are you just like sitting out the rest of that round?
When you die, it's actually kind of fun, because when you die, your character is technically dead, but everybody else can call on reinforcements. So they can, in the same way they call on an ammo drop or a turret drop or something like that, they can call on an extra soldier, which means them having to essentially hold down the L1 button and input a code, usually under fire, usually while running, usually while screaming, to drop a new pod in the ground under which you will emerge. But I like the detail that whenever you come back as a new character, you have a new voice, because you're actually literally playing as a new character.
Nice.
So there's a limited number of respawns. I think that in a 4-player squad, you can bring back dead players 20 times. I think it's 15 for 3 people, 10 for 2, and so on. You can always come back, but it's the responsibility of the rest of the team to find the time to do it. And so sometimes they'll be screaming like, oh my God, we're under fire, we're surrounded. I was like, then bring me back, I can help you. And say, no, but I don't want to bring you back, I got to stop shooting and put the code. So people like running and lobbing grenades behind them and just trying to say, like, the moment they bring you back, they die. So now you're back on the ground, so you have to bring them back. It just leads to all kinds of insane cycles like that, which, like I said, it's really fun.
Awesome. Okay, so that's Helldivers 2. That sounds great. It sounds like a Starship Troopers game that doesn't have the technical license to the IP or whatever, but in everything but name, it sounds like a Starship Troopers experience. So it's pretty awesome. Cool. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for today's show. You can find more about all the stories that we mentioned on the show at slashfilm.com. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Google, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe to our newsletter. There's a link for that in the show notes as well. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.